If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Hello and welcome to episode 56 of Piff. What's this show called?
Pixel Sift, dude.
Pixel Sift.
I know we have some issues today, but come on, man.
I know, having issues with my mouth. My name is Gianni, at least I think it is, who knows at this point. And I'm joined by Pixel Sift Next Gen, Mitch.
Yep, hey, what's up?
And Pixel Sift.
I don't really feel very Next Gen today.
Well, in comparison to Pixel Sift Retro, Scott.
Yeah,
you hey. Are. And that's a pretty awful joke, and thank you for that, James. It's a lasting legacy that he brings with us. We are joined by a much better James in every single respect of the way. And your name is James Cook, and you're from Super Cookie Games. James, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Very, very glad to have you in the studio. You've been joining us for a good portion of the afternoon today. So
a bit longer than usual.
Yeah, exactly. So James will be telling us all about his game, Crazy Coasters Rainbow Road, a little bit later on, and joining in our topic discussions, which are Scott.
Okay, so the first topic we'll be talking about today is the future of AI and how a certain RTS may help evolve our technologies.
Yep, and we're also taking a look at... I'm so distracted. So we're all taking a look at regionalization for games, how games modify them, like how game developers modify their content to fit a different audience.
Exactly right. Let's jump into it, shall we?
Did you know Pixel Sift is available on other platforms? You can find previous episodes on iTunes, Pocket Casts, YouTube, and on the Pixel Sift website.
Have you ever played a game against an AI that was disappointing and lacking in challenge? Well, those days may be behind us. One of the more softly received announcements at BlizzCon 16 was that the team up of the makers of StarCraft 2 with Google's DeepMind branch, which is dedicated to developing sophisticated intelligence. They've teamed up to use the advanced gameplay of StarCraft 2 to develop and further the skills, challenge, and learning of artificial intelligence. And that's what we're looking at for today's first topic.
I think, you know, we're talking about the challenge of a game, right? So
yeah.
I don't know that DeepMind's going to be playing against you on Battle.net anytime soon.
No. But it's not going to have its own profile.
I can tell you what the StarCraft AI does do to me on a regular basis.
Just nuke you?
It nukes everyone.
Wow, look.
And no matter how many humans are against it, it finds a way to nuke everyone.
Hang on a second. Yeah. Wait, we're going to be teaching an AI how to nuke everyone?
Seems like a bit of a...
I think the interesting thing about this is the DeepMind project is using a game to develop the next generation of advanced intelligence. We saw earlier this year there was a program also developed by Google called AlphaGo, which was able to beat the best player of the game, sort of a Japanese board game, Go, was able to defeat him repeatedly just because they could go through every single calculation in the world. You know, we've seen stuff like this happen before. This isn't the first time that a computer's been able to beat the best person in the world at the particular game. The one that I remember the first time that came out, and, you know, Pixel Sift Next Gen may not remember this one, but when Garry Kasparov was defeated by Deep Blue, which is developed by IBM.
You're right. I have no idea what that means.
They're all just no idea what that is. So yes. It's a computer that could play this game called chess.
Really?
Yeah. They have made video
games. What's chess?
It's an old school RTS.
Yeah. It's a tabletop game.
Analog RTS.
Yeah. It's a table. Yeah. Exactly. It's tabletop. It's got many different plays.
You can have to show me that later from the RSL.
That's right. I'll send it from the RSL. We'll get a cheap beer while we're there.
Yeah.
So basically, the big thing about this is that AIs at the moment are doing very specialized tasks. So playing a game of chess or playing a game of Go is a very specialized task. That AI, if you try to apply it to another context, it couldn't do it. It's not designed for that. It just wouldn't work. The interesting thing about this StarCraft II development is that the complexity of the game, while it's still a game, is actually a lot higher than, say, playing a game like chess. You know, there are multiple different strategies.
Yeah, because instead of, like, with a game like chess where you have pieces, or in StarCraft II's case, you have units, like, they're not static, and, you know, movement isn't turn-based either, so that helps create a better benchmark for the AI, basically.
The interesting thing, I think, would be is that, obviously, that you talked about this earlier, Mitch, as well, is that StarCraft does have a computer player built into it that is designed for playing StarCraft. Are they just going to use those rules and apply it to, you know, like, Google's DeepMind project and then make the best StarCraft player in the world? And basically Korea is just going to, you know, give up. They're going to shut down their TV channels, you know?
Well, see, at the moment, sorry to steal that answer away from you, Mitch.
That's all right.
The way it works currently for these AIs is that a bunch of guys that really know the game well develop a system so that, you know, once resources reach a certain point, the AI will do this. And once, you know, units reach a certain point, the AI does this. And the idea is basically just to kind of remove that and make it more intuitive and make it actually intelligent rather than just reaching quotas and then performing a mechanism.
So how do they have any idea of how they're actually going to be teaching an AI? Or are they just going to throw them in front of a...
absolutely no idea how this is going to work. And they don't know
kind
how...
Kind of like us and me and Jess. Like,
I mean, they obviously have some kind of idea how it's going to work, but they have absolutely no idea how it's going to, what it's going to happen or what the results are going to be. It's a bit... it's crazy up in the air at the moment, which is exciting, but so also not helpful for...
Are they going to test this AI in StarCraft? Or are they going to give the StarCraft AI some real-world problems to solve?
I think they're going to test it with StarCraft too.
Right.
But also, there's something about this whole system being very open as far as the advancement of the AI goes. It's going to be something that's not going to be hid behind closed doors. So other people that are working in advancing AI will be able to kind of work alongside them, almost.
James, do you think you could apply Google's DeepMind project to any of the games that you've developed? Are they a next stage after they've beaten StarCraft, they'll move on to something that you've made?
Well, I find the whole concept really quite interesting because I imagine it's going to be like a machine learning style process where they will just continually play the games over and over. I mean, I find it particularly interesting. I mean, as you pointed out, Scott, that AI at the moment is very procedural in terms of if X happens, do Y, then do Z. Mm. So, I mean, then what will happen in StarCraft 2 when they release DLC? And they had is the machine going to adapt? Because that'd be really cool if they could just throw in a bunch of whole new units it's never seen before, and suddenly it's got a strategy. I think it'd be really cool, especially for esports at the top of the game, you know, to see the advanced players. Me personally, I kind of like my AI a bit flawed, so you've got some exploits to be able to win the game.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm feeling like multiplayer is a little bit too much, it's nice to be able to just play against the AI and cream some competition for a bit. But as far as the distinguishing, how it's going to distinguish, you know, between characters and whatever, basically that's the huge hurdle for them. Instead of it just doing, A happens, B, it does B, it needs to be able to differentiate and see the player, the screen, how we see it. So basically, they're going to have to work it so that the game and the AI hold information separately. So just because, it's like, say there's a fog over because you have an unexplored territory, the computer won't know what's under there. Like, at
just
the
like
moment,
a person.
That's not how it works.
Mm.
But just like a person, exactly. So it will receive data in that kind of way. So separating it from the computer itself.
It's interesting. I think StarCraft 2, and you touched on it there, James, that you know, the esports level is very, you know, there is an ideal way to play, and some of these things are down to milliseconds if you do them at the right time. To me, that sounds like a computer program, right?
You are
programming a correct ideal path, and that seems something that's ideal for a computer to do.
Don't quote me on this, but I think the ideal actions per minute, I think actions per second, I think for a StarCraft player is like, I think 20. Mm-hmm. Or something like that. They can actually click the mouse that
many times
and that many times. And a computer will probably not even have to deal with that because a computer doesn't have any mechanical constraints.
Doesn't have to, you know, deal with meat space like we do.
RSI.
It can just plug in directly using USB 2.0 probably and get that mouse working 100%.
Maybe they just join up with the other side of Google and have hardware arms. So they do actually use the mouse and stuff. You know, nice. Throw that into the mix.
Yeah, that'd be good. That'd be really
Well, here's how we'll know that the AI would have made it. It'll, when the patch notes come out, it'll be the first one in the top of the, it'll be the top rated comment bitching about the nerfs to the Battlecruiser or something.
Exactly.
That'll be there. Like Google DeepMind, the robot DeepMind will be there.
Very interesting. Look, I think this is something that's going to be, obviously, once it masters StarCraft, which of course is a, you know, an ideal path sort of game. What's it going to move to next? Is it going
to be world?
Is AI going to be taking out you know, people in Call of Duty and, you know, trash talking them there? Or maybe it will move to a politer world where an AI doesn't need to waste its time telling you you're terrible. It knows mathematically that you're terrible. So, you know,
its very existence.
It'll be like above the level of trolling. It just won't even need to tell you you're bad. It'll just ignore you.
It'll just close your bank accounts or something like that.
Yeah, and not want to group up with you.
Look, really fascinating. We'll see a bit more of this as it comes along. Right now, though, let's jump into our next topic.
Bring it on, DeepMind.
Pixel Civ!
It's not Pixel Civ, it's Pixel Sift.
Pixel Civ!
And we are joined in the studio today by James Cook. He is from Super Cookie Games. Half based in the UK, half based here.
Yeah, that's right. We're quite a global team, the two of us.
Using the magic of the internet to kind of, you know, telecommute between the two places. James, tell me a little bit about the process of designing your games. You know, you've got a team that is split across there. How do you go through? You've had a large number of releases. I think it was 14.
Yes.
14 releases now with your newest game, Crazy Coasters Rainbow Road, number 14. Tell me how that works. How do you make a game?
Okay, so I know he's probably watching this thing, so I'll just mention him. Dan, my partner in crime, he's the UI art designer guy. I mean, I can only do code. I can't draw at all. If you saw my drawings, it wouldn't work. But really, I mean, the way it works between us, not one of us has pure direction in terms of we're going to do this, it's going to be X, it's going to be Y, it's going to be Z, we're going to do that. It's more of, because of the beauty of the time split, one of us can write down like a wall of text in a messenger app, send it across, and then the other person says, oh yeah, that's a good idea, and then send back the thoughts. You've had time to think about it and kind of evolved over time. I mean, none of the games that we've had released look and act how they were when they first started. It's kind of like an evolving process.
One of the big things that I find really interesting as well is that you have this sort of, I guess, policy that you want to make sure that you actually release something when you start on working on it. Does it mean that you kind of do get to a point with games when you're just like, okay, that's good enough, we just have to go and put that out because now we need to do it? Or do you feel like this is a good motivating thing to actually get something to as good as you can get it and then put it out?
It's definitely the motivational side of it. I mean, we don't have deadlines as such. Because I mean, we do this spare time sort of stuff, so we never say, right, end of September, we've got to launch. But at the same time, we like to start with clear, realistic goals. So that might mean keeping the idea simple. So for Crazy Coasters, as an example, that just started off as a concept of a ball rolling around a hill. Yeah, we thought, yeah, I wanted to learn some more physics and how I'd get that going. And then it kind of evolved into this idea of a roller coaster. I mean, there was a game about 10 years ago that was released on the old Symbian phones. That's where I drew that inspiration from. And then Dan comes in and adds, oh, it'd be great if it, you know, it was these characters and it looked a bit like Happy Tree Friends and, you know, there's the carnage involved. So we just gradually built it up and now it's obviously got to the point where it's live. So it's more, you know, we just want to see things done, get it out there, you know.
I like how you mentioned Happy Tree Friends because that's immediately what we thought when we first saw the game. We're just like, oh man, Happy Tree Friends. So these characters actually appear in your other games. So how quickly did they take the leap from their very, I'd like to say, like, I guess, he's grounded in reality games to this very almost violent environment of Crazy Coasters?
Well, it came about really because, I mean, from the art perspective, at least how I view it, it's very intensive. You can kind of call it like a content furnace if you keep trying to churn out new stuff all the time. And so really we look at what assets can we reuse, what game can we, you know, where can we take these and reuse them to reduce Dan's workload in terms of making up new art, and he can focus on the other aspects of the game as opposed to reinventing the whole thing. So yeah, it kind of started off as that, as an idea, and I wonder if Happy Tree Friends was his inspiration for the original characters. But
one of the interesting things, I guess, as you mentioned that as well, is that there is this sort of disconnect between the cutesiness of it and the sort of family friendliness of it. And the other game that you made with the Baboos, the characters that you have in there, is sort of an all ages friends, you know, kids game. I mean, as I was looking this up, you have had someone kind of say to you online that, oh, I thought this was great. I was playing this with my toddler or whatever. And then there was a bit of carnage in the game. I'm just wondering, like, is this something that you've sort of thought about when you were putting it together? Because, I mean, you have got a similar theme, a similar set of characters, but now in a sort of different context.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, there is that sort of disconnect between the two worlds. But the games themselves are fundamentally different. I mean, one's a puzzle-based game. The other one's more of an arcade-style game. So, like, the player bases don't tend to overlap. But the game itself, we were very honoured to be in the Google Play Early Access for Crazy Coasters, which meant we got a place in the Play Store and we got loads of downloads, which was great. We got loads of review feedback. And by far and away, we had more people saying it should be more blood, more gore.
Oh, really?
I mean, I do sympathise with the people saying, oh, I thought this was going to be a kid-based game and it was going to be child-friendly and such. But, you know, when you do a game through Google Play, they make you do a questionnaire on the content. You know, what does it contain? Is it cartoon violence? Is there nudity or whatever? And so you fill it all out. Now, at the end, pops out a rating. So I think it's actually rated mature in this region, and then there's PEGI 7 in other regions. So it's not, we've not gone out there with the idea of it being family friendly as such. You know,
So like, one of my favorite parts of the game is the soundtrack and how it just makes me uncomfortable in almost every way. How did you make that?
Oh, well, okay, so that's that was Dan again. He's probably giggling as he's listening to this, because that's actually him laughing over the track, and he spun it up and changed the pitch. Because, again, he was just thinking, like, this is a theme, you know, it's all cutesy and we're all going to have laughs, and then it all just changes to screams and cries and whatever when things start to go a bit wrong.
Because I was playing it earlier, and I was just playing it by myself, and then James, our video producer, was sitting over here, and then he's like, "What are you playing? That sounds terrible. It's like it sounds really scary."
And then and also, like, with that Happy Tree Friends kind of vibe, with the really high pitched stuff, but also with the gore stuff, you know, it's uncomfortable and almost even annoying at the time if you're not playing it. Mm. Like, were you worried about? I guess this is probably more of a question for Dan, but were you guys worried about walking that line a little bit too sharp, you know, and making it an annoying kind of experience?
Well, really, I mean, the way it ended up sticking was how I found myself humming it at the end of the day. Mm. And then it was like, this must be working.
You
know, yeah. I appreciate, I mean, what you're saying, you wouldn't want to be sitting on the bus playing full volume.
Absolutely not.
but that's when we kind of knew we were right, because we both said, yeah, I was humming this at home on my own. I wasn't even playing the game.
Absolutely, and playing it is completely other thing. You completely get immersed in it and you enjoy the sound and whatever. But it was just something I was wondering about. Mm.
I think it's really fascinating. We were talking about this a little bit earlier on, and all of the games that you have are free-to-play games. They are none of them paid. And we were talking about the value and the value proposition of what a free-to-play game is. You do this as sort of a part-time hobby, and this is kind of like, you know, your fun thing on the side almost. Do you think there would be is there a good spot for developers to make, you know, the transition easily, or is it something that you would be interested in doing, and can the market support that?
We're going to a paid...
Yeah.
I think there's two real facets to that. There's one, if you've got brand recognition, so as we all probably know, everyone listening to Super Mario Run's coming out for iOS, that's going to sell like hotcakes because Mario... we saw the same kind of phenomenon with Pokemon Go, even though obviously that's not paid, but again, brand recognition. And then the other facet is if you've built up a substantial player base. So I do know there are developers out there that have made free-to-play games and they've got thousands and thousands of people, and then they've done, here's a paid version that's taken out all the oddities people didn't like, and that's been successful. So, yeah, I mean, personally, the way we approach these, I don't think it would bother me too much if we did paid. I mean, it would take really a company to come along and say, hey, we've got this brand, do you want us to make us a game? And be like, well, actually, you know, then that changes things a bit, you know, because it kind of raises the profile of everything. But
what would be the bar that you would say, okay, maybe we should start thinking about making a paid game?
I think if we start getting the call for it, you know, if people start, if we kind of got the player base there to support, to facilitate that, really. I mean, that, and also if we build up a brand and it steamrolls, I mean, if you end up with like a bit of a Candy Crush saga and it goes forward, or even a Flappy Bird, I mean, you could go and branch off that brand, and it would be a starting point, right? So, yeah, it would be a big step, I think, for us at the moment.
Well, look, it's a definitely an interesting game, definitely one to check out. You've got, if you know that one doesn't take your fancy, you've got 13 other ones to try out as well. So, James, where's the best place for people to go if they want to play some of the games that you and Dan have put together?
If they visit our website of supercookie.co.uk, all the links are there. We're on the Play Store, we're on iOS, we're on Amazon Store. And for those that are still playing them, we're on the Ouya as well.
Oh, really?
What?
Yeah.
I have additional questions. How does that work? Do you have an Ouya?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, man.
I've got so many devices at home, it's crazy. It's just mostly out of sheer interest.
Is that the one with the peculiar controller?
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah.
Nice. Basically, it was supposed to be, the early sort of Android TV style sort of thing where you would have all these games that would kind of fit in there. And the big premise of it was you back it on Kickstarter and then you never have to buy a game again.
Yeah.
Do you know how many people are playing your games on Ouya?
On Ouya? I don't. However, I do know one of our games. I don't know if you saw it, Thug Racer. It's like an Outrun-style game. And that got rips off the Ouya site via some Chinese company, or it's in some Chinese app store. It's all attributed to Super Cookie Games. They haven't tried to pretend it's them or pass it off. But that gets so many installs, it's crazy. But unfortunately, there's no revenue or anything attached to it because of the way Ouya worked, there was no advertising or anything. So, yeah, I think you get like 1,000 downloads a day for people playing that game in China somewhere.
Wow.
Over time, you know, they're really enjoying it.
That's awesome.
But Ouya, yeah, I mean, that's kind of all died off now. I mean, I think people are turning them into like home theater systems and such.
Yeah, it's kind of a little hacky box now, and that's all it does. Look, James, very fascinating. Stick around. We might jump into our next topic now.
Watch episodes, let's plays and more at youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
Yeah, so games often go through some changes before they are sold in other countries. The process of localization is supposed to make the transition between cultures smoother and help the game find a new place in a foreign market. But as we've seen time and time again, the people in charge don't always get it right. So you've been playing Pokemon, Johnny.
I have been playing a little bit of Pokemon. And
what have the AIs been saying to you?
Well, it's one of these things where it's when you see it, it's really jarring because the rest of the game is actually quite well written and quite, the complexity of the plot is actually a lot better than some of the other ones that you would be playing. The other Pokemon, so it's not just run around, take your monsters, fight a bunch of other monsters, beat some people through to the end. They have tried to do a little bit of a better job at writing this story. But there are some sort of strange sort of localization errors. And you can look online if you have a squiz and type in, you know, localization, translation, Pokemon Sun and Moon. There's plenty of examples out there. This is something that is kind of, I guess, really interesting for people who have to make games and then translate them to other markets where they may not be, you know, a fluent speaker of their language. James, I'm going to ask you a question first to throw to you as the resident game developer in the room. What is it like supporting a game for a variety of different languages? I'm sure you aren't fluent in all of them. You may know a few, but...
Well, it's a very interesting topic. I mean, our approach to our games is try and remove the text element from it. But then, I mean, text translation is just one of the areas of localization because you've also got to consider some things that might be on display that are okay in some countries or not in others. So a good example of that is the classic Castlevanias, where in Japan there was crucifixes everywhere, but they got taken out in the American release. So, you know, for us, we don't tend to cross any lines. We're trying to keep everything in the middle to keep our lives easier, but... there's plenty of services out there for us to use for text translation.
There was a really nice Castlevania mix-up in Symphony of the Night where it said you were doomed as soon as you lost the ability to love. Which is, you know, it makes sense, but that's not what it was supposed to say.
Well, that seems very poetic, actually.
That's right. That's really true. Yeah.
It's a little bit emo.
Yeah. Well, Castlevania's a little bit emo.
Yeah, true.
And I think, obviously, we were talking about this a bit earlier on, but, you know, there are the classic examples, the All Your Base Are Belong to Us.
Yes. Like I said, the original internet meme.
Yeah.
That's from Zero Wing.
Allegedly.
All Your Base Are Belong to Us.
Yeah, I think this is something that's obviously, you know, there must be a lot of games that start out in English and then get translated across into to other languages and to other, you know, in markets and things like that, where they have all these hilarious things. But, you know, we have live in a Eurocentric, English-centric world. So these are the ones that we know about as when these things, other games come across into.
Well, in other industries, like I watch a lot of dubbed anime, and they actually get someone just to write another script for it that just meets, like, rough, well, not, I wouldn't say roughly, but like that gets the same messages across. I wonder if that's what needs to be done about our games. Does a Western person actually need to rewrite large sections of it just so it makes sense to a Western context?
I think, you know, you talk about games like that. Yes, obviously that does make sense in a TV show sort of format, right? Yeah. So that follows a format. But a game is not always going to be the same. You know, you can have a game and it's Crazy Coasters, or you can have a game and it's Final Fantasy 15, and it's not just get someone else to write that thing. You need, right. If you're making Final Fantasy 15, the person needs to be involved at every stage of that.
That's true.
It's not something you could just say, we'll redub this episode.
And like, successful translation is more than just the words. Like, proper localization is far more than just replacing the words correctly. You know, you've got soundtracks and accents and even like the accents of the eyebrows and stuff. You know, some of these are culturally different. I know that I remember they changed Kirby quite a lot from Japan to US because of that exact reason. They weren't going to convey the feelings and emotions enough, so they gave it angry eyebrows.
And I think it's always a perfect example. James, I'm sure you can relate to this as well, but you know when people in movies, for example, try to pretend to be an Australian when they obviously haven't got an Australian person to talk to this, or they may talk about people from the UK as well, and they try to, you know, do a few of the phrases, and that obviously doesn't
work. You're
going
to do some of those phrases right now?
No, I'm not going to do some of those phrases. You would know what they are. But yeah, like, I think that's something interesting, that there is that cultural context that isn't always just as simple as language, and some of those decisions have to be made at, you know, at the thing. I mean, it's a tough job. I don't envy anyone who has to do it.
It's a lot of research and effort, and honestly, a lot of maybe just living in the place for a long period of time.
Well, that's it. I feel like somebody from the place where they're trying to make it localized should be involved in it quite heavily, for that aspect of the creation, at least.
James, you've moved from the UK. You've been here for a couple of years. What are some of the things that you were really kind of surprising to you versus your idea of what Australia is?
Oh, wow.
Great, Johnny. He's going to have to comment on our country.
That's fine. That's all right.
I'm still here, so, you know, it's all good.
It's all good.
Yeah. I thoroughly enjoyed being here. I mean, I didn't realise how big cricket was here, is one thing I've noticed. And also, everyone assumes, because I'm English, we're just as crazy about cricket. But the coverage of cricket here is the same as our coverage of soccer back in the UK. I mean, you've got Adam Gilchrist presenting programmes over here. We've got Gary Lineker presenting programmes over there. So there's that aspect to it. And there's also a lot of American culture here that I wasn't really expecting. And I used to, when I first came out, it was like, oh, it's a mix of English and American culture. But actually, no, it's Australian culture. I mean, that's kind of how I see it really now.
So, for example, if an Australian was writing a game that was set in the UK and it was focused on cricket, they may give it higher prominence then, you know, maybe it actually is worth, because, you know, there is these sort of assumptions that people kind of make from any of your perspectives about, you know, what this sort of thing is. So, yeah, very, very fascinating. I think this, when you're trying to make a game and trying to sort of simplify it down into all of these things, you have only got so much time, you know. You may be trying to make something that works.
Yeah, all these things we mentioned to do it properly, they take a lot of time and effort. And absolutely, you need to get probably teams of people to do it right. So I do kind of understand when occasional slip-ups are made.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, all of the classic ones that have happened on the NES games and SNES games have been just like, you know, all your blazes belong to us. You understand it. It's pretty funny.
Yeah. It's a good little joke. I mean, as you said, James, there are services available now that allow people to get their things kind of, you know, there's services like Mechanical Turk, which, you know, you can get things translated. And also there's direct translation programs that are the similar sort of system, where you basically pay someone to translate your game into a different language. So, you know, using the internet, we're able to kind of share a lot of this information and come to a good middle sort of position, I think, which is always good. So, you know, this is something that, you know, it's maybe a bit of a chuckle that we'll have. Yep. But, you know, it's a hard job and, you know, keep at it.
As pro wrestling used to say, a winner is you.
Exactly. Well, look, that's all we've got time for today. A winner is you for listening to this episode of Pixel Sift. This is episode 56. I'm Gianni. We were joined by James Cook from Super Cookie Games. James, tell us a bit more about your website. So, for example, if people want to go visit it, and what's the best place to get your newest game?
So again, it's just visit supercookie.co.uk. You can go, it's mobile compatible and stuff, and all the links are there. So the majority of our games are up on there. And then, it'll lead you through to the Play Store, or you can just search for Super Cookie Games on
social medias.
Yep. Twitter, we're on there.
All the regulars.
All of them. in the Play Stores, and it will pop up in some form.
Cool. You'll also pop up on our website, which is www.pixelsift.com.au. We'll put up links to that so people can find all of the links up there as well. Scott, we're on social media, are we not?
Yes, we are. You can find us actually fast, facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsift, twitch.tv/pixelsift, and youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
And Mitch, our other episodes, if people want to watch them or listen to them or do whatever they want to do with them.
You can do whatever you want with them on pixelsift.com.au and also on YouTube, iTunes, Pocket Casts, or using the RSS link on our page.
Look, and a very big thank you to Sarah, who's come in at very last minutes to help us with the video production today.
Thank you, Sarah.
Couldn't have done
Cheers,
it without
Sarah.
You.
Top work.
We will be back again this time next week. Thanks, guys, for joining us.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, James.
Thanks.
Cheers. Peace out.
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.